just a quick moment, opportunity to introduce Shamba Bislas, who's here.
I have no idea how this works, but I will figure it out.
More importantly.
Uh-oh.
Why don't I go ahead and introduce you? While
that's just fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Shamba is the Paul Garrett Professor of Politics, Political Science at Whitman College, and you probably all know her as the author of Nuclear Desire, Power, and the Postcolonial Order, which was published by University of Minnesota Press in 2014. She's also co-edited some quite interesting books about torture and about states of exception in international relations, and her work in its interdisciplinarity, its contemporaneity, and its critical stance towards prevailing conventional mainstream trends and IRs of great interest to us here. And it's a pleasure and privilege to welcome her. So I'll hand you over to her, so long as she can get through the technology.
I think I have it figured out. Yeah.
Okay? If not, I can rustle up Sophie, who's the wizard.
This is just fine. I got it.
Okay, great.
Yeah, my 13-year-old son made the Prezi. I'm trying to figure out how to work it. So I have to use it. Thank you, John. So I'm going to start with a personal narrative. I've been inspired by the new narrative IR approach, as well as the older feminist IR approach. And I'm trying to write more from the place of the personal as political. I'm nowhere near as eloquent as Himadi Mubidi, who writes just beautifully in the narrative voice. But I want to begin this talk with a meditation on my own insertion into various nuclear histories, both to frame my personal investments in nuclear abolition, as well as mimic the contrapuntal and abolitionist ethic that I'm trying to formulate here. And this is a work in progress. This is my attempt to put it out in public and see what I get back. So here goes. For the last decade and a half, I have lived 60 miles downwind from Hanford in Washington State on the west coast of the United States. There you go. Hanford is the site on the banks of the Columbia River where the first reactors of the Manhattan Project, designed to produce plutonium on a significant scale, were built. At the time, the highly secretive Manhattan Project was part of the US war effort to build a nuclear weapons capacity whose spread the US had hoped to control. But once the US monopoly on nuclear weapons production was broken, first by the Soviet Union's nuclear test in 1949, followed by the British nuclear test in 1952, US President Eisenhower inaugurated, as you know, the Atoms for Peace program in the name of harnessing the enormous powers of the atom for peaceful purposes, but also, this is important, as part of US Cold War strategy to recruit allies through the sharing of nuclear technology. Those efforts helped establish the nuclear program in the country where I was born and came to adulthood. For years, India celebrated its peaceful harnessing of the atom and proclaimed its abhorrence of nuclear weapons, but conducted its first nuclear test in 1974, although it labeled it peaceful at the time, and eventually in 1999, more openly declared its nuclear weapons intentions, followed in short order by Pakistani nuclear tests, the eastern part of the country from which, before it itself split into two, my parents were refugees. The city of my birth, Delhi, now lives under the looming shadow of nuclear devastation from rivals who form the split histories of my inheritance. India continues to be seriously committed not just to its nuclear weapons program, but also to expanding its nuclear power capacity, even as it faces resistance from civil society groups and communities deeply concerned about the establishment of nuclear weapons, of nuclear reactors, whose radiological effects will be borne by them and their children into the indefinite future. To return to where I started, Hanford is the most contaminated nuclear site in the United States. The radioactive waste from its barrels leaking, even as the costs of its cleanup rise exponentially. The plutonium produced at Hanford was used to build Fat Man, the bomb that destroyed Nagasaki. The only victim of wartime atomic use, Japan proclaimed its abhorrence of nuclear weapons like India, but embarked on a vigorous civil nuclear program whose proponents persuaded an understandably reluctant society to subscribe to the myth of nuclear safety, and it is a myth. This faith in the beneficence of nuclear energy was deeply rocked by the 2011 tsunami and the ensuing devastation from the multiple reactor meltdowns at Fukushima Daiichi, leakage from which into the Pacific Ocean brought fears of nuclear contamination in Japan to the west coast of the United States, where I live now. The reactor meltdowns in Fukushima Daiichi brought Japan's nuclear program to a halt, but 5 years later, nuclear reactors now appear to be slowly going online, even as massive numbers of people and civil society groups remain deeply and profoundly worried about the current and future dangers of nuclear power. I could add more strands to the story, but I suspect you get the picture. From the complex interrelated strands of the story, I want to ask, what kind of complicity, if any, in the making of the global nuclear world does an Indian child of immigrants from Pakistan living near Hanford, Washington, on the west coast of the United States have for the devastation visited on Nagasaki 70 years ago? What kind of obligation towards nuclear disarmament emerges from that messy complicity? Now I actually can't see everybody, so I'm going to stand up. I began with these intersecting narratives in part to locate my own complex investments, physical, emotional, ethical, and political, in the question of global nuclear disarmament, but also to pose the following broader question. What can we, as scholars of international relations from different theoretical persuasions, different social locations, and different subject positions, learn from seeing the different political histories of nuclearization as globally connected to each other and to our particular localized perspectives on the question of nuclear politics? How can we develop a conception of that global connection that can respect the historical specificities of different nuclearizations while developing some notion of a shared universality of nuclear experience? So I would like to use Edward Said's notion of contrapuntality to suggest that developing such a complex notion of global nuclear connections might perhaps help us enunciate a global disarmament ethic from the perspective of the victims of nuclear power. And I'm going to suggest that we need to expand the category of nuclear victimization beyond the wartime use of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in ways that I believe raise the stakes of nuclear pursuits. As may already be clear from the story with which I started this talk, I think this ethic forces us to consider the already conjoined histories of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy as inseparable. In other words, I'm making not just a disarmament, but an abolitionist argument that includes elimination of nuclear power for both nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. And although I'm going to talk a lot about weapons here, I want you to keep in mind that I'm also thinking about nuclear energy more and more in a context in which it is being offered as a solution to climate change, and I'll get back to that at the very end of the talk. Urging a more complex linking of the temporalities and spatialities that often divide our thinking on nuclear politics and inhibit our attempts to think together globally and historically toward a common investment in nuclear abolition, I would like to consider the formulation of a global ethic on nuclear abolition that can help connect what appear to be disparate nuclear worlds. Okay, so one of the central challenges in conceptualizing a global ethic, as I think post-colonial thinkers have reminded us repeatedly, is the tendency for the global to lapse either into an abstract universalism, erasing both historical specificity and cultural difference, or redound to a universality that is simply the generalization of some parochial perspective. This is what we usually call Eurocentricity. I think that you can see both those forms of globalism, an abstract globalism as well as a parochial globalism, at work in the nuclear politics literature. So let me give a couple of examples. So for instance, most of our inherited histories of the bomb have been narrated from the perspective of the great powers, the Cold War superpowers more specifically. And much of our thinking and imagination on the utility or the future of the bomb comes from the telling of that history. For example, if, when, and how deterrence works or fails, the stability-instability paradox, the fears of proliferation. Some of the new positions on universal nuclear disarmament are premised on this Eurocentric form of globalism. For example, a very surprising cast of characters, often referred to as the Gang of Four, has emerged as major and serious advocates of disarmament. So these include from the top left, George Shultz, Ronald Reagan, Secretary of State, William Perry, Secretary of Defense under Bill Clinton, Sam Nunn, Democratic Senator from Georgia and former Chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and of course, Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon's and General Ford's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. So whatever you might think of any of these people individually, you would not confuse any of them with bleeding heart liberal peacenecks. They're all well-known cold warriors in the US and were at one time supporters and even architects of nuclear deterrence. But together they have mounted a fairly visible public relations campaign to persuade current leaders and policymakers of the wisdom of moving to global nuclear zero. They're really prominent voices in the global nuclear zero movement now. They published a famous Wall Street Journal op-ed column in January 2007. A video titled Nuclear Tipping Point that came out of this initiative was apparently shown to President Obama in April 2010 that reportedly had an enormous impact on the president. These are people considered respectable in the arms control community, arguing for universal nuclear disarmament. But the argument of this group is essentially that we need to get to nuclear zero because deterrence that worked during the Cold War, and they helped make it work, will obviously fail in what is called the second nuclear age, where much less trustworthy and certainly much less rational actors possess or may possess nuclear weapons. So they are enunciating a globalist ethic in making a case for universal nuclear disarmament that makes the whole world safer, but it is a parochial or a Eurocentric form of globalism. It won't come as a surprise that shortly after they published this piece and in the face of criticism for suggesting that the US should disarm, the Gang of Four declared in another op-ed that while they was, that while they still remain committed to nuclear zero, and they claim they still do, it was premature for the US to give up its nukes while others still had them. Right? So this is an ethic where the goal of disarmament always recedes in the face of proliferation concerns. Right? It never actually becomes a reality, but it's something they remain committed to. So that's the first kind of parochial globalism. But there is a different kind of globalism in the positions on nuclear disarmament that you see, for instance, in the writings of Jonathan Schell, to which I'm actually very sympathetic. These positions on disarmament that premise themselves entirely on the horrors of an absolute weapon that must be abolished for humankind in the singular to survive risk slipping into the mode of abstract universalism that post-colonial scholars also caution us against, erasing the very particular uses for nuclear weapons and power in particular moments, the different desires that motivate nuclear pursuits for different states that are positioned very differently and unequally in the world, and the different effects of nuclear pursuits as experienced by communities and peoples at different times and places. So I think it erases those heterogeneities. I also think that this form of universalism that you see a fair bit in the nuclear abolitionist movement with good reason, and of fetishizing nuclear weapons as absolute weapons, as evil incarnate with magical powers of destruction that are utterly different from any other kinds of weapons. I have argued elsewhere that this view of nuclear weapons can also end up driving the desire for nuclear weapons. So that's the abstract form of universalism. I would like to suggest drawing from Edward Said, in place of an abstracted or parochial globalism, a different kind of globalism that involves a concrete and sympathetic awareness of the multiple experiences of a cohabited nuclear world, As intellectuals, we all carry, says Said, some, and this, these are his words, working understanding or sketch of the global system. But it is our direct encounters with it in one or another specific geography, configuration, or problematic that shape our political commitments. So in a sense, we are all formed parochially, but instead of generalizing from that one experience or abstracting away from it, we need to connect that experience, suggests Said, with other distinct but overlapping experiences and worlds and account for the multiple histories that are also distinct but intertwined and intermeshed. Now you can see what I was trying to do with the story I started with at the start of the talk. The method that Said offers for developing this notion of a universal borrowing from music theory is contrapuntality, a form of analysis that attempts to arrive at a global understanding by accounting for various unique, distinct, yet interconnected histories and geographies, composing it, as it were, not so much a symphony, but what he calls an atonal ensemble. contrapuntal readings account for the specificity and individuality of multiple experiences, and I quote from Said, "We must be able to think through and interpret together experiences that are discrepant, each with its particular agenda and pace of development, its own internal formations, its internal coherence and system of external relationships, while remembering that they are all coexisting and interacting with others." So Said is insistent that these histories and experiences are distinct. This is not a form of melting pot hybridity, right? And that none are to be privileged. But his plea is also not to simply valorize plurality. This is not a liberal celebration of multiple voices and perspectives, but to theorize a wholeness out of them while remaining attentive to power and hierarchy. So there's several post-colonial IR scholars who've attempted to use a contrapuntal analysis to understand the constitution of some of the foundational institutions and concepts of IR, such as sovereignty or the Westphalian state or system stability or the notion of security itself. I'm suggesting that we need to learn to read the histories of the nuclear bomb much more contrapuntally than we have so far. Because the bomb is so nationalized, right, it's revered as a national monument, it's built through very restricted, secret state deliberations. Most of the histories of the bomb that we have are national stories, and many of them are in the form of trying to figure out what was going on within the black box of the state in making the decision to acquire the bomb. So, for instance, rejecting a univocal reading that understands the decision to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki entirely from the metropolitan perspective of the U.S., and as I learned at a recent workshop at Princeton on the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there is still such an obsession, especially among U.S. diplomatic historians in particular, at understanding all the different dimensions of the U.S. decision to bomb. You know, what was going on in Truman's head? What was Stimson thinking? How much did Truman really know? A contrapuntal reading urges us to not reject that history, but read it with and against the other histories of World War II. Most importantly, of course, from the perspective of the Japanese victims of the atomic bombs, as well as Japanese involvement and actions in that war, but also, for instance, the colonial subjects who were recruited into that war for or against the Japanese through their own complicated relationships with the Allies, or Allies themselves like the British and the French, who would go on to mimic U.S. nuclear might as compensation for their own losses as colonial powers, or even post-colonial societies like India, for whom a nuclear program became an attempt to recover their dignity in a new post-war world that had demonstrated the awesome force of the atom. I think that this sort of contrapuntal reading begins to offer us a much more complicated and global history of complicity in the legacy of nuclear arms proliferation, while remaining attentive to the very concrete circumstances of choices and decisions to pursue or forsake the bomb or keep open the paths to it. Said asks us to look for these sorts of what he calls counterpoints to dominant narratives, to recover what has been left out of dominant historical accounts, and to do so in a manner that will, and I quote him, will not allow conscience to look away or fall asleep. For this conscience to remain alive and to develop an awareness of this sort of complex hybridity, it may perhaps be more useful to begin from the margins of the nuclear world. This is not because narratives from the center are less important or less consequential than experiences from the peripheries, but because despite the fact that all views are partial, the margins offer us a view that arguably provides us a fuller conception, a larger, a more expansive conception of nuclear harms. Between a modern master and the non-modern slave, one must choose the slave, says post-colonial theorist Ashish Nandi, not because the slave's suffering is superior or because the slave is oppressed, but because the slave represents a higher order cognition which perforce includes the master as a human, whereas the master's cognition has to exclude the slave except as a thing. These are words from Nandi. It is from the margins, suggests Said, that a more expansive view of the global is available, from which to rethink and remake universalist, ethical, political, cultural claims, thus displacing its assignation as a site of the local. So where are the margins of the nuclear world? In what kinds of peripheral places can we find the reach of nuclear power and perspectives on that power that help augment the narratives from the center? What kind of universal can we build from those narratives? When we think of nuclear dangers, our imaginations are often captured by the spectacular, albeit intermittent, dangers of the use of a nuclear bomb or a nuclear accident in the form of a reactor meltdown. So the common images we have are of massive mushroom clouds, exploding reactors, and enormous plumes of smoke, right? Those are the general images of nuclear dangers. But if we broaden our reach to think of nuclear weapons not as a fetish commodity with magical power of its own, but an object, like others, that emerges out of a production process and whose institutionalization as an absolute weapon has required a series of human decisions to ensure its potency, we begin to see an entire gamut of insufficiently accounted for nuclear harms that are not reducible to nuclear use or nuclear accidents. So I'm going to give several instances of this. For example, our focus on the enormous brutality of Hiroshima and Nagasaki as the only historical moment in the use of nuclear weapons makes it possible to divert attention away from the 2,054 other nuclear test explosions that might well be considered to be used mini bombs, by 2,054 nuclear test explosions. North Korea has been in the news a lot recently. How many of these has North Korea exploded? 4. The UK has 45 nuclear test explosions to its credit. The US conducted 1,054 of these tests. In fact, you could consider, and Joe Masco calls the US the most nuclear bombed country in the world, which of course risks recentering the US unless we consider where on the margins of US territory these tests were conducted and which groups it affected. This is a point not lost on the margins. For instance, on April 24, 2014, the Republic of the Marshall Islands filed lawsuits against the 9 nuclear armed nations for failing to comply with their obligations under international law to pursue negotiations for universal nuclear disarmament. There's one short article, Article 6 in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, that urges nuclear weapon states to disarm, that nobody really pays any attention to, except the Marshall Islands, I guess, and there is a reason for that. From 1946 to 1958, the United States conducted 67 nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands. If their combined explosive power was divided equally over that 12-year period, it would equal 1.6 Hiroshima-sized explosions per day. 1.6 Hiroshima-sized explosions per day for 12 years. Right? So I'm not trying to diminish the scale of destruction wrought in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but I am trying to draw attention to the longer history of danger caused by nuclear weapons if we were not to isolate one instance of weapons use. Similarly, we could expand our category of nuclear harms if we consider the long-term radiological effects of depleted uranium munitions with a radioactive half-life of 4.51 billion years. These figures don't make sense when you even say them aloud, 4.51 billion years. But depleted uranium munitions don't really make it into our category of nuclear weapons. Nina Tannenwald has helped popularize the term nuclear taboo. Some of you might have heard it. The unwillingness of states to use nuclear weapons, given how abhorrent they now seem to be, that no states are likely to use nuclear weapons, it's called the nuclear taboo, which she sees as evidence of successful global norms diffusion. I think that when we think of the nuclear taboo, we should remember the still unfolding effects of the use of depleted uranium in Afghanistan, Bosnia, Kosovo, Kuwait, Serbia, Somalia, Chechnya, and in unprecedented quantities during the 2003 Iraq War. In fact, we can think contrapuntally about this. Where did all this depleted uranium come from? From the over billion pounds of nuclear waste generated from the US nuclear weapons and nuclear power production, much of it during the Cold War. Depleted uranium munitions are relatively cheap ways for the US Department of Defense and US Department of Energy to hand over some of this waste to arms manufacturers to make weapons that are not taboo to use. Right? They are an effective form of waste management, or really waste exportation. Right? We know there's a long history of exporting toxic waste to third world countries. but here through much more directly explosive forms. If we unraveled the nuclear production process even more fully, we begin to see harms that begin even earlier and continue into the indefinite future, from uranium mining to milling, processing, enriching, reprocessing and separating, and all the way to storing and disposing of nuclear waste. Harms that are borne disproportionately by workers who handle nuclear materials, communities that house nuclear sites, and future generations who must live with nuclear waste. As Shiloh Krupper has so brilliantly enumerated, nuclear waste lives not just in leaky barrels and open fuel tanks, but also accumulates in soil, water, and the air, in the crawl spaces of downwind homes, and especially within the bodies of workers, when it is not being exported through new forms of weapons. That workers and communities most adversely affected by uranium mining, reactor sitings, nuclear testing, and waste storage are amongst the poorest, often indigenous, historically colonized populations of the world is now well documented, revealing something that post-colonial IRs have been belaboring for a while, that the so-called long peace of the Cold War was neither particularly peaceful nor cold, especially not cold if you consider it radioactively, from the perspective of these victims of nuclear pursuits. For those of us who have talked previously of all the ways that the Cold War was pretty hard for victims of many of the superpower proxy wars around the world, we have sometimes forgotten that it was pretty hard within the territorial boundaries of those superpowers as well, contaminating large swaths of land and proliferating countless diseased and broken bodies who are also victims of superpower nuclear might. These kinds of dangers are much more mundane, more widespread, more constant, and much less visible than the dangers of nuclear use. And I don't want to diminish the dangers of nuclear use. We live in a world in which about 1,800 nuclear weapons are still on hair trigger alert. And nuclear use remains a part of the strategic doctrine of many nuclear states. So I don't want to diminish the dangers of nuclear use. But these sorts of dangers are a reminder that nuclear weapons are dangerous, not just in their use as that absolute weapon that nuclear abolitionists rightly frighten us about, but also their possession. So the two images that I couldn't figure out how to make, but I wanted to juxtapose with each other, was a map of the world with the 9 nuclear states, which is usually the map of nuclear proliferation we see, with the territorially bounded nuclear states, and a map of the world that takes full stock of the radioactive impact of nuclear weapons possession, right? That would include those 9 nuclear weapon states, but also radioactive fallout all over the world, nuclear tests, which would include the Pacific, uranium mining, which would include Kazakhstan, Australia, and Africa, which never makes it into a map of nuclear harms, right? It's really, truly global in its impact, in ways that territorially contained map of the world doesn't quite reveal. I'm going to take a short... There's a school of nuclear abolition. It's now called the Humanitarian Consequences Ethics School that does focus on the everyday harms of nuclear weapons possession and with whom I'm aligning myself. But it gets very little traction, and I'm going to take a short detour here to suggest why such an articulation of nuclear harms that, while intellectually compelling, is not quite resonant. It does not quite take hold of our sentiments or emotions or feelings. And I want to do this because I just read Joe Masco's recent book. Joe Masco talks about how citizens, especially of nuclear states, were affectively recruited into nuclear fears, how the Cold War played on their affect. His focus is mostly on mass media cultural productions of civil defense exercises and the post-apocalyptic cinematic narratives used during the Cold War to create a fearful public in the United States. Citizens for whom, he argues, it practically became a civic obligation to imagine and feel the death of the nation state on a regular basis every single day. This is a very weird way to live in the world, right? And I think we don't quite understand the American obsession with military security unless we can fathom what that does to one's psyche. Masco argues that there are at least two results of this aesthetic politics of emotional management. First, U.S. citizens can only make sense of existing or impending non-nuclear crises through nuclear tropes. So, and he provides examples of this. Some of you will remember the use of the mushroom cloud image to make the case for the 2003 Iraq War, right? The widespread description of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans as a post-nuclear apocalyptic scene. But this kind of way to conceptualize crisis only in existential terms also allows active deflection away from all sorts of everyday forms of lived insecurities, not just related to the nuclear harms I mentioned before, but also loss of jobs, decaying urban infrastructure, and of course, as I will return to later, the much more mundane effects of climate change. In fact, Masco argues these everyday felt vulnerabilities in turn feed the affective conditions of possibility for more militarization, and they make demilitarization practically impossible to imagine. Second, Masco argues that the stunning enhancement and fortification of the post-September 2001 national security state in the name of fighting an anticipatory preemptive war against mobile, uncertain, and often entirely imaginary set of threats carried in the figure of the terrorist with the WMD, a terrorist with a weapon of mass destruction, was made possible by this affective reservoir of a nuclear Cold War. The terrorist with a WMD is a combination of two very imprecise categories that can be filled with all kinds of content to produce what is felt as an existential threat. This is a non-nuclear but nuclearized threat, which has nothing to do with how easy or difficult it is for terrorists to acquire nuclear weapons. It works on the affective register to produce a citizenry that genuinely fears that eliminating nuclear weapons makes them more insecure, even if you were to make a convincing case that the possession of nuclear weapons is killing them as we speak. And I'm not exactly sure if other nuclear states, such as this one, experience the world in similar ways. But I think the question of what sort of political aesthetic allows the mobilization of affect on forms of less spectacular harms is a critical one for the nuclear abolition movement. I think we have a real representational challenge here, and I'm not sure how we get to that. Slow violence is the term that Rob Nixon uses to describe, and I quote from him, a violence that is dispersed across time and space, an attritional violence that is typically not viewed as violence at all, a violence that is neither spectacular nor instantaneous, but rather incremental and accretive, its calamitous repercussions playing out across a range of temporal scales, end quote. The distinctiveness of nuclear weapons has usually and rightly been described in spatial terms, right, in terms of the scale of its destructive power. Unlike later deterrence optimists like Kenneth Walls, who famously and controversially argued that more may be better, more nuclear weapons may be better, early realists like Morgenthau and Niebuhr appreciated rather well that the explosive potential of nuclear weapons exhausted the capacity of a territorially contained state to deliver security in any meaningful sense, right, or to contain the spatial damage caused by the detonation of a weapon. You could expand the scalar level even further and in a different direction if you were to take into account the cellular mutations within the human body that exposure to radiotoxins cause. But to that scalar distinctiveness of nuclear weapons, one should add the temporal distinctiveness of nuclear power as a form of power whose toxicity plays out across such a vast stretch of time, like millions and billions of years, that it even further overwhelms all our existent institutions of accountability. This kind of violence does not register as violence, both because it lacks the spectacularity of bomb use, as I have said before, and because its effects are borne mostly by the marginal, dispossessed, disposable populations of the world, whose legibility as victims of nuclear power, of nuclear violence, is much harder to establish. Gabriel Hecht has shown that the nuclearity of an object, whether that be a nation, a technology, particular materials or processes, or a workplace, is not given in nature as a stable ontological fact, but established through a process of contestation with different interests at play. So for instance, there was a time when the production of uranium was highly secret, which fortified its nuclearity. But with the discovery of multiple sources of uranium and the emergence of a market in uranium, the mining industry actively resisted attempts to establish the nuclearity of uranium. So it could actually, so there could be a market in uranium. These shifting definitions of nuclear status affected not just the regulation of working conditions in those places, but also the ability of workers and communities to recognize and articulate the particular occupational hazards of uranium mining and seek and receive recognition and redress for the health hazards of uranium mining. This shifting designation of nuclearity, especially to aspects of the nuclear production process furthest removed from actual weapons production, such as uranium mining, has had profound consequences for what kinds of nuclear effects become legible, what kinds of regulatory apparatuses can be created, and who can claim protections from harms. Krupar has shown how difficult it is, even for workers in decommissioned plutonium-producing factories, where we know a lot more about the medical effects of chronic toxic exposure, to register their claims, even in the US, where there is now a compensatory regime for that. And by the way, that regime, ironically and contrapuntally, created its compensatory metrics from data on radioactivity exposure studies of Japanese atomic bomb survivors who were victims of the bombs these workers helped create. That's where the data for the occupational hazards of plutonium production comes from. You can imagine how much difficult it is for uranium miners in Africa who are not even recognized as nuclear workers, even when they are recognized as fully human, to be legible as nuclear victims. What sort of relational global ethic allows us to account for these sorts of intersecting and contrapuntal connections between victims of direct bomb blasts, whether from atomic bombs or depleted uranium munitions, victims of fallout, victims of nuclear tests, nuclear workers, and uranium miners? A grounded universalism of the sort that Saeed suggests is best crafted from the perspective of the marginalized, because it is a reminder that while we all are vulnerable in a world with nuclear weapons, and we all really are vulnerable despite whatever our states tell us about the effectiveness of nuclear deterrence, the distribution of that vulnerability is not democratic, so that some of us have already been harmed by the pursuit of the security promised to all of us. Some of us with less access to the means of civil defense will be rendered more insecure if the security promised to us via nuclear weapons fails, and that some of us are already dead or dying so that others can enjoy cheaper and cleaner electricity and richer lifestyles. Last year, citing the dangers posed to humanity by global climate change and the continued existence of enormous arsenals of nuclear weapons, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved the hands of the doomsday clock 2 minutes closer to midnight, so that it now stands at 11:57 p.m. For those of you who don't know, this is a representation. This is the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists representation of how close the world is to nuclear apocalypse. This move implicitly recognizes that while the rush toward nuclear energy reliance may have appeared to stall post-Fukushima, with Germany charting out a path recently thought impossible by many, this hesitance about nuclear energy cannot be expected to last in a world in which nuclear energy is offered as the panacea for green development, especially for countries in the global south on whom the pressure to catch up to the standards of global north consumerism while minding their carbon footprints is immense. A heart-wrenching opinion piece in the New York Times recently connected the threat of planetary annihilation posed by both nuclear weapons and global climate change. Risks that face us all, exposing us all to our deaths as a species. Risks that teach us, says the author, that perhaps the task that looms before us in a futureless world is to learn how to die. Right? And there are other philosophers of climate change who are talking about learning to die in the Anthropocene. But the author of the New York Times op-ed piece reminds us that while those risks face us all, those risks are not distributed evenly. And so while it may be that we should all prepare to die, the ethical demand in learning how to die as a species is for each of us to learn to live in a way that does not ask others to let go of more of their lives or live with more fear of imminent death. The author recognizes the powerful idiom of the doomsday clock, but also its built-in problem of universalism. It puts us all, in the words of the author, it puts us all at the same place on the same timepiece, We know, of course, that in the ticking clock drama of planet Earth, some of us are closer than others to the zero hour, and some have reached it already, end quote. What I have urged in this talk is the need to craft a form of universalism that can account for our common vulnerability in a nuclear world while remaining attentive to the multiple disparate yet interconnected nuclear experiences of that world, and especially in solidarity with those who have suffered the most from its excesses. Our survival as a species depends on taking stock of these global connections. Thank you.
Many thanks for that very interesting talk. I'm going to open up to questions and answers. Do you want to come and sit down?
Sure. Yeah. There? Or I can sit down there. Or I can turn that off too. Yeah. I'm happy to take questions, have a discussion, take comments.
My name is George. Thanks for that very much. I'm teaching at the moment. Mine is a completely speculative thing I was just thinking about as you were talking, which is if you swapped your analysis of nuclear stuff for environment and climate, would it help us? In the, those are the two issues that strike me that are globally constituted in the serious sense that you talk about and require a global effort if they're to be managed effectively. And there are clearly overlaps when it comes to pollution and hazardous waste and lots of the stuff you're talking about. But it seems to me that the climate justice movement has had the type of resonance that maybe some of the nuclear disarmament hasn't, at least hasn't for a generation or so. And it's not because of the high-profile figures point, because you made that clear. It's not because there's not an intellectual argument, you also made that clear. And it's not for a lack of grassroots sentiment and effective solidarity.
Right.
So if that's right, why is that? And do you think it's right, A, and B, if so, why do you think there is this difference? It really strikes me there are really considerable overlaps between the two.
So you're asking why it's
the
case
that... Why do you think
the
environmental stuff has been more effective than the type of development of a nuclear global effort?
Right. So there was a time when I think the nuclear disarmament movement was much stronger.
Yeah,
I think it sort of died with it, right? It sort of died with the end of the Cold War. And I think there are still activists on the ground, right? And there are still a lot of activist organizations that are talking about...
There's a big march in the weekend here.
Yeah. So I think some of the urgency or some of the sort of fears of an impending nuclear apocalypse just sort of dissipated at the end of the Cold War. Even though, again, we live in a world with about 1,800 nuclear weapons on air trigger alert, so even that fear of a catastrophe is still very much out there. And even though, as I said, there are all kinds of nuclear harms that are killing us every day. So I think in part it died because the Cold War was seen to end. I think the climate change movement can teach us a lot. I mean, in part, I think we need to connect those two movements, and I think there are some attempts to connect them, the nuclear disarmament movement and the climate change movement. But I think the climate change movement has also done a great job of pointing to various forms of environmental racism, right, which is what I was talking about in the ways that nuclear harms have affected vulnerable populations around the world. So I think there's a lot to be learned from the climate change movement for the universal for the nuclear disarmament movement. But I think we also need to talk about them together, because I think nuclear dangers are very much climate dangers.
There's one, I have heard once or twice British policymakers saying that they wouldn't mind if there was a small nuclear exchange.
Because
that might actually generate the type of global ethic that you're talking about. It could be contained in one place, it would be terrible, but then this apocalypse would be back on the table, because you can't get it this apocalyptic scenario anymore.
Right.
There's no equivalent there of climate change, right? What would that look like? But it seems to me that the apocalyptic story has worked for climate justice, right? This is where we'll be, and that's present and everyday and something that people get.
Right.
Whereas the nuclear one has gone away. I mean, as you said, maybe it's because of the
because there hasn't been a massive explosion since Hiroshima. Yeah. Although people say that the increasing number of hurricanes sort of works similarly, in that they get
there's a small policy window that opens up then,
right,
where people start talking about climate change much more, and that is maybe what will get more serious concrete action, and then they disappear again. But nothing on the scale that would happen with a nuclear exchange between two nuclear weapons states. There's also, of course, there are folks in the nuclear disarmament community who joke about the use of nuclear weapons creating a nuclear winter as a solution to climate change.
I wonder if there's a problem in your analysis.
It probably is.
By effectively collapsing the military use of nuclear technology with the civil use of nuclear. I understood what you were saying.
Right.
It was a kind of nuclear zero vision. It has an emotional appeal. You could probably build some kind of rational argument for it as well. Looking at this problem with a large time frame. So rather than looking at it from the point of view of the policymaker here and now and the kinds of things
mm-hmm.
running through their minds,
mm-hmm.
looking at it in a much longer time frame. But of course, when this question has arisen, the two have been separated, and indeed it doesn't follow that by seeking to eradicate nuclear weapons technology, the logical next step is to eradicate all nuclear technology. Indeed, often in the process of diplomacy, in order to encourage and incentivize states to abandon one, you make it easier for them to obtain the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking aloud, really, but there seems to be a problem there not addressed in this narrative that you presented. The other thing that occurs to me, that there are a couple of words that are absent in the analysis. One is risk and relative risk, because the British debate has taken place to a large extent around the calculation of various kinds of risk. And the other, going back, I did a bit of
risk
work.
Of
the risk of a nuclear accident
mm-hmm.
versus the risk of not being able to provide for our energy needs into the future.
Mm-hmm.
The risk of a nuclear exchange versus the risk of being left defenseless
mm-hmm.
to some unknown
mm-hmm.
threat in the future,
mm-hmm.
WMD threat, that kind of thing. That the debate has been focused on those kind of issues. The other thing is international institutions. I wonder where they fit in. I did a bit of work on British thought in the 1940s, so in the very early years of the nuclear age, and the left in Britain has been wrestling with this ever since. It's
mm-hmm.
wrestling with it now. The latest chapter in that particular story. In the 1940s, the answer was international institutions, so the International Atomic Energy Agency, a huge amount of hope was rested in the Security Council recently created.
Mm-hmm.
That dimension seems to be lacking in the analysis.
Yeah. So you had many.
Yes, I know.
So
I know.
The UK, you actually have now a possibility of a leader who is openly talking about, right?
We actually don't have a
but possibility. Okay, but at least a serious.
Unless you've been Bernie Sanders.
Although Bernie Sanders has not talked about nuclear zero, because
no,
Obama did. He hasn't talked about nuclear disarmament at all yet. Perhaps he might take a nuclear zero position. President Obama actually was the the first U.S. president in maybe ever who talked about universal disarmament. Famous speech in Prague.
SDI.
Reagan did. For a moment there. Yeah. That was a moment.
Neither did
Obama, it turns out, right? I mean, so there was a lot of excitement in the arms control community that a U.S. president dared to use the word universal disarmament. But then he ended up actually putting in a ton of money into nuclear modernization. He, after winning the Nobel Peace Prize for having made a gesture towards nuclear disarmament in addition to other things. So there is an enormous there are all kinds of international organizations that take up the question of nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament.
Yes.
Right? There's an enormous nuclear non-proliferation regime. With many different parts. A lot of them are, some that are truly international, many that are regional. There's a lot of interstate cooperation on nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament. In fact, I would say that regime keeps proliferating. There are more and more organizations that are added to that network. Whereas the question of disarmament always gets pushed to the future. So there are many different parts of this regime that has taken up this question of disarmament. But they talk about non-proliferation and disarmament together as part of one phrase. The disarmament always gets recedes when proliferation remains a concern. So it always becomes, the efforts always get put on non-proliferation efforts. The question of so I don't want to conflate nuclear energy pursuits with nuclear weapons pursuits, although I think the two are very, very heavily, very, very much connected. So the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty actually allows, even encourages, I would say, states to invest in nuclear energy while prohibiting nuclear weapons. It makes that distinction very clearly, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty does. It draws sort of a bright line between those two pursuits, even though many nuclear weapons programs have come through the pursuit of nuclear energy, right? That was the case with North Korea, that was a signatory of the NPT, that pursued a nuclear energy program with international legitimacy, and before it decided to explode its weapon, you have to just give a 3-month notice to withdraw from the treaty. Withdrew from the treaty and then did its first nuclear test explosion. Many other signatories of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, including Japan, right, are considered breakout states. Right? They have a nuclear energy program and have the capacity to create nuclear weapons very rapidly, very quickly. I mean, worry about Iran, but there are all kinds of nuclear states who are signatories of the NPT who could produce nuclear weapons if they decided to do so tomorrow. And in Japan, there's actually, right now, there's a debate on this question of whether Japan should again become a nuclear weapon state, or should become a nuclear weapon state. So I think you can't, even though I don't want to conflate the two, I think you cannot separate the two. And I think you especially cannot separate the two in a context in which nuclear energy is really being sold as the solution to climate change. Mm-hmm. So if we have proliferating nuclear energy, I think the risks of nuclear weaponization are even greater. Yeah.
Sharma, thank you for that great talk. It's very interesting. I particularly the account of contrapuntalness I thought was really brilliant and very useful. I got a sort of mess of questions. The first of which is just to pick up a little bit with the exchange with George. I mean, one way of looking at climate change, the climate change social movement, is as kind of like the human rights movement, as located in Western middle classes and probably in its end times. Another way of looking at it is seeing it as something that's global and that has taken off in new and different ways from the margins. And I think you want to be clear about which of those climate change movements you're getting into.
Right, there's the environmental justice movement versus
I think it's an important distinction.
Absolutely.
My comments sort of go from inside to outside. So starting in the inside, I thought the account of nuclear harms could be expanded. I found it a little bit anemic.
Okay. Okay.
And then I think there are sort of social and cultural realms that you could go into very powerfully. One of them, I think, which is really profound, is the nuclearization of physics as a discipline,
mm-hmm.
as a science.
Mm-hmm.
The way in which physics became a certain thing when the U.S. state and its nuclear weapons program took such a direct interest in it,
mm-hmm.
and funded it and developed it. We don't know what physics would look like if we'd had a physics that wasn't affected by nuclear national security.
Mm-hmm.
I think a second thing in which...
Can I just interrupt you for a second there and hook that up with the climate change question? So Joe Mastor argues in his book that the infrastructure that has helped us understand climate change actually emerged out of the nuclear arms race.
Yeah.
So all sort of our infrastructure of seismology that helps us detect some nuclear tests when they happen. All
sorts
of data that was gathered. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So the very fact that we know what we know about climate change now isn't part of a product of...
It's just that I think we think of sciences as existing separate from society
and
politics.
Right.
They don't
yeah.
exist separate
right.
from geopolitics. I think there's... The other one is the vast expansion of the secret state that nuclear weapons have made possible. The way in which fear of espionage went to a new level and justified and legitimated all manner
mm-hmm.
of secret state stuff. And I think moving off into the kind of cultural realms that you were getting into with the affect of apocalypse, the way in which the trauma of the sort of end of the world stuff that Cold War nuclear contest gave to us all,
right.
and what that made possible in culturally speaking. So I think one could expand that category, I think, in some quite interesting ways. So that's the first point. The next point I wanted to make is a really funny thing going on in how people are thinking about a strategic strike and how to do it without nuclear weapons. So the Russians have evolved a whole set of weapons which will take out all your power, destroy your internet, disable you in terms of your electric and communication stuff, but not being nuclear.
Uh-huh.
So there's a whole set of strategic weapons now which are not nuclear weapons.
Right, right.
And I think which sort of...
nuclearized. In a sense,
without
being an explosive.
Without being, they're not nuclear weapons. They're
right.
they're conventional munitions.
Right.
But they're understood to have strategic significance.
Right.
And I think it begins to put nuclear weapons ever further away from usable strategic stuff. There's something really going on in the way that people are starting to think about strategic bombing again without using nuclear. And I just wonder how that impacts into your debate. If you look what people are really afraid with the Russians, it's not... nuclear London, it's this kind of threat.
Right.
Which when you
switch it in Mayfair.
Which you couldn't respond to with a nuclear weapon.
And does that make then nuclear disarmament more difficult or more easier? You don't need to worry about it.
It seems to me very interesting to think about how that...
So
you're
saying there's no way to escalate from one to the other. We can actually have a conventional exchange again without going there.
But then it puts the onus on you as the nuclear power. You're going to nuke Moscow when they've just taken away your electricity.
Right.
Right? You can't do that, right?
Yeah.
But then what do you do then?
So
that's another thing. And then the last point I wanted to make is try to turn your globalism, your parochial globalism back at you. Is it not the case that there is not a democracy of nuclear threat in the world? There's an oligarchy.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans are much more vulnerable to the detonation of nuclear weapons on their soil than other peoples. Is that not right?
Because?
Trying to take away a little bit. You're wanting to say that you're wanting to expand the category of nuclear harm so that it becomes global. And not in a way that is a thin globalism, but you're drawing out all the connections.
Right.
And I'm not saying that those things aren't the case. But sort of thinking about why it is that some states, some peoples, and some democratic politics may be pro-nuclear, more pro-nuclear than others, and more ready to want nuclear, more ready to accept having nuclear weapons. Isn't the threat of being hit with a nuclear strike or a nuclear threat, isn't that particular in particular parts of the world? So India and Pakistan, much more likely than South Africa and Nigeria, and the United States and the Soviet Union and Britain, much more vulnerable to any possible weapon that militant Islam might get a hold of or other geopolitical competitors, so that the experience of fear, of nuclear fear, is in fact not global and democratic, but more oligarchic.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that.
Then what does that do to some of your claims about the sort of globalism of the globalization of nuclear harm?
Yeah, so my understanding of the globalization of nuclear harm is not just about being vulnerable to the detonation of a nuclear weapon, right? I think if that was the only metric, it is true that some parts of the world are more vulnerable than others.
I think it's not the only metric. I guess I'm saying that politically it's a very significant metric.
It's a significant metric, but I think that because we just focus on that metric, we can see the other forms of harms, right? So I think there are people who have died already from possession of nuclear weapons. That has not happened for Americans yet, right? So I wouldn't disagree with that, and I also don't want to conflate the different levels of those harms, but I want to recognize that there are many different kinds of harms that we need to account for. I want to take up the question you had about the affective register, because I'm really trying to think about this, and I haven't quite wrapped my head around it. And I'm really taken by this question of the ways that fears work on the affective register that make it more or less difficult to disarm. With climate change too, I think in part because the climate change is sort of nuclearized in the way that the US talks about it sometimes, it is precisely, as you were saying before, when we see these massive effects of climate change in the form of hurricanes, right? So, and that's when people start mobilizing about climate change, rather than sort of feeling the everyday vulnerabilities that come with climate change. And I'm not sure how to change that affective register. And I do think that's a remnant of the Cold War and the ways we've thought about fear. These sort of broad.
It's made the end of the world thinkable and possible,
right,
in ways that it remained millenarian and religious.
Right.
Nuclear weapons. I mean, that's Carl Jaspers, you know.
Yeah. So how do we get away from that? I mean, I think it's a real challenge for the abolition movement, is that you can't get people to think about harms other than through these massive nuclearized tropes. Also for climate change, not just for nuclear weapons, but for climate change as well. That's a real challenge for the climate change movement.
I have two questions. One about you can have that as well.
Yeah, that's all right.
One's about contrapuntality. The other goes back to the affective register of fear, which might then go back to George's first question and some of the other ones as well. In terms of contrapuntality, I should mention I have a colleague in government department who grew up in Los Alamos, and his wife grew up in Novosibirsk. So I wonder if they have
an affective
register. I wonder what the kids are like. But seriously, thinking back to your earlier book and to your discussion of Said and the notion of post-colonial, I guess I wonder whether it's worth adding to this attention to those post-colonial states that are trying to develop nuclear power in a way that is situated regionally in terms of, you know, Iran's position,
mm-hmm.
That is situated in historically in terms of the development of science, Jayaprakash and others, in terms of India and dating back to, you know, the notion of science as a measure of man,
right?
In various colonial contexts. And then in North Korea, likewise, in an area of advanced American containment and a role of American nuclear power, nuclear weaponry, across the Asia Pacific. So I think, I wonder whether there's a specific kind of post-colonial context in which one should situate the ambitions and desires of these states. In terms of the affective register of fear, I guess maybe it's the Susan Faludi's book after September 11th that she starts to talk about how people love to be afraid, right? I mean, you have these crazy Americans in like North Dakota who think that there will be a terrorist attack on their little town in North Dakota, and there's clearly a great deal of pleasure associated with being afraid. Like, I don't like to go on roller coasters, but some people do. Or know, whatever. So that it, to that extent, it could, another competing hypothesis here would be that the pleasures of being afraid of nuclear holocaust have been replaced by competing, you know, more easily, visibly, you know, scientifically, you know, reenacted, reproduced, available ways of being afraid that are divorced from these sorts of scenarios. You don't need to duck and cover. You know, there are other ways of reenacting and experiencing the thrill of being afraid that your little town is going to be attacked and so forth.
Yeah, so I am actually getting more and more interested in thinking about affect, and I'm starting to dabble a little bit in affect theory for that. But I think you're absolutely right. There's this pleasure and fear. And I think, you know, part of what we're seeing with Donald Trump's ascendancy, dare I say, is this sort of enunciation of pleasure at these rallies that we see in worrying about terrorists and Muslims.
Mexicans.
And I mean, you know, fill in the blank.
Mexican as well as terrorists.
Fill in the blank, not the American. So I think you're right. I mean, there's a lot going on at the level of pleasure there. Your first question, my answer is yes. Mm. Right? I mean, so the desire for nuclear weapons across the world, for nuclear power as well, not just for nuclear weapons, has very much to do not just with trying to meet your energy needs, not just having to do with security dynamics, but to be a serious state that gets taken seriously, right? That registers seriously. The nuclear weapons for the US and the UK are also very much national monuments, as they are, in fact, I would say more national monuments as they're instruments of state security. I mean, in fact, I think you can make a really good state, a really good case for Iran actually wanting nuclear weapons for security reasons rather than just for prestige, which is the reason that gets repeated. If you look at the geopolitical map of Iran, it's surrounded, it's completely encircled by hostile states, by American presence, right? Completely encircled by American presence. And Iran can make a better case for being strategically more insecure than I think many of the existing nuclear weapon states.
And when it began, it had a Soviet neighbor.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Just building on that, you mentioned in your talk the two very ill-defined terms that kind of play on the affect register of fear, terrorist and WMD.
Right.
And I'm wondering how then, well, I can see how the kind of rhetoric around Iran hitting a nuclear bomb has been used. And I was wondering if that would be a good kind of entry point into looking at the effect of register of fear in this case.
Right. And that's what NASCO does.
Yeah.
So this category, terrorist with a WMD, can be filled with all kinds of content, right? It really is a fill-in-the-blank sort of category for both ends of it, the terrorist and the WMD. WMD is a very imprecise category, right? It includes nuclear weapons, it includes biological and chemical weapons, which are very different substantively from nuclear weapons. It doesn't include all kinds of weapons that are depleted uranium munitions. And then terrorist, of course, as we know, is a fairly signifier. It can be filled with all kinds of content depending on the context. And when you put those together, that creates a really sort of pleasurable fear to go back to. Right? You really can love to hate a terrorist with a WMD.
The narratives around fear might be the best solution or the best way to actually get disarmament to kind of pick up by creating or securitizing the possession of nuclear weapons themselves. So rather than having this image of, like, you know, the terrorist with the WMD, sort of trying to desecuritize that through narrative and create, sort of make it scary to have the possession. And it's almost like that kind of discourse has to be changed. And I think using the same tactics of like the fearmongers that we see sort of dominating politics right now, if the disarmament movement uses that and employs that, that might be sort of a way, I think, to do that and to gain momentum.
But what's the image for that? So the image we have for that fear is the explosion.
Right?
It's the mushroom cloud.
But I wonder if like a lot of what you were talking about, these sort of more insidious, long-lasting, like that I think has resonance and is scary. Like as, you know, as I was looking at it, I was thinking like, wow, that's sort of like, you know, you've unseen insidious, like, what is it, the depleting uranium, like, that's also frightening. And that I think is something that like,
meltdown of the reactor, the uranium that you can never dispose of,
the
seeping into the ground, and the water table, it's that kind of thing. You've got to get away from the mushroom cloud because that seems to have retreated.
Exactly.
But I don't know what the image, you know, what the sort of, how you represent that in ways that really grab.
Especially because it's so unseen, so visual.
Because it's so unseen, and because it's, you know, uranium mining is like most other forms of mining.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Aaron Brockovich.
Well, you could start with Chernobyl.
The
effects of Chernobyl, if you were to build up this case.
But
the interesting thing there is how quickly it's forgotten.
Right.
Yeah.
Jay.
Yeah.
The youngsters.
I just wanted to take on a slightly different tack then. But thank you for that talk, and I thought that was really compelling, kind of argument you were making, especially about the things that are included when we kind of construct nuclear threat as only a weapon, right? And I really like that aspect of your talk. What also struck me is this kind of universalism project you were talking about, where we're trying at the same time to string together common vulnerabilities, at the same time it's paying attention to differences and interconnected parochial experiences, as you were talking about. And I think many of us are trying to grapple with that kind of universalism versus the particular and how to square that circle. So I was wondering if you would talk a bit about more about how you do that in a good way, in a scholarly approach, so things that could potentially be left out, because if you take parochial voices and you try to string them together, how do you know you haven't left something out that's important? The guilt of maybe imposing a universalism that you had critiqued, and now you're imposing your own kind of universal commonality. And also this idea of, I really liked your idea of the atonal ensemble, but how do you convince others?
It's not
that
mine.
I wish it was. The question is, how do you convince others that it's still music, right? If you've built this kind of mass.
An atonal ensembles tend to have a very narrow picture.
Yeah, the Bartok man.
So I think the challenge is to how to craft a narrative that can tell these multiple stories and show them as distinct but also connected, right? I think that's the challenge. And I'm trying to sort of visualize for myself that if this was to become a larger project, then what that looks like. Whether it's one long narrative, or whether it's separate stories. So, you know, you could tell a story about, you can tell a story about the acquisition of nuclear weapons that connects different parts of the world and different forms of nuclear harms. Or you can tell several different stories of different forms of nuclear harms. So I don't think there's a formula for doing this, right? The challenge is to write the narrative that strings together as one story that's telling you a story about this common vulnerability, but that's experienced differently by different people. So I don't know if that answers your question. I'm still trying to figure out how to write that as a longer project. What the different sections of that look like.
Do you have fears that you'll leave something important out?
It's not a complete story ever, right? You always leave things out. But its integrity in part depends on being able to show that they're connected, distinct and connected. Mm-hmm. I mean, those two parts, right? So it's not trying to tell, it's not a history of the world where you include, you know, everything. That's you can't do that. Mm-hmm. But to show that there are points of intersection, but they're, you know, I was going to say parallel intersection, that doesn't work geometrically. Mm-hmm. But they are distinct stories, but that intersect at different points and sort of hang together. I don't know, I hope it's somebody's dissertation.